In the last half hour, when we were interviewing a professor from the New School in New York, Derek Hamilton, a fabulous, fabulous professor, he did a piece called The Color of Wealth. And I found Derek by looking at one of my favorite sites, nakedcapitalism.com. Let me repeat that site, nakedcapitalism.com. If you are curious, if you have questions about the economy, if you want to know about your world, it is just a fabulous, fabulous place. I mine it all the time. I need to tell you that Eve Smith has pulled together a group of people who are remarkable, who assist her, but their level of curiosity is just fabulous. So I am looking at Naked Capitalism the other day, and in fact, I linked this article to what I sent out in our schedule yesterday, not realizing that I would actually get the individual who wrote the article entitled Food Price Inflation as Redistribution. And it's an analysis of corporate power in the world food system. And I thought, well, this is always exciting because we always talk a lot about agribusiness on this show. And I framed it this way. If the names Kraft, Monsanto, Cargill, Nestle, ADM, Walmart gets you curious, or as my husband says, gets you furious, this interview is for you. Joining me right now is a doctoral student from York University in Toronto, Canada. Joseph Baines is the author of this very, very interesting paper that Eve Smith begged us all to read. And since I wasn't sure you'd read it, I thought Joe would be available to at least walk us through the history of food, the history of the food business, and how it has so dramatically changed, and what that change means for you and me. Let me welcome Joseph Baines to the program. Hey, Joe, how are you?
Hi, Ani. Very good. Thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure. So I need to start by saying to you that I have an interesting food background. My grandfather worked for the AMP for 50 years and got the gold watch. And my husband was in the fruit and vegetable business, and it was a family business that he was in from the time he was probably in utero to about 42 or 44 when he left. So I have a family that has always been sort of wedded to food and food distribution. And they have this sort of history of it. What I would love you to do is, in 25 minutes or less, walk us through your paper, because what your paper does is not only talk about the players, but about how the relationships have changed and where we are now going as a world when it comes to agribusiness and how they really control so much of not only what we consume, what we pay, whether we have an abundance of food or a lack of food, because I think the arc of change is something we are not familiar with.
Okay, well, I can begin by just outlining the argument of my paper in the broadest terms. Over the last 100 years or so, we've witnessed two interconnected historical trends. The first is that large corporations have become increasingly dominant in the production, distribution, and also the consumption of food. And there's a related trend, which is that grain-based food in particular has become increasingly prominent in agricultural production and also in diets across the world. And this dual trend has had many ramifications. The increased significance of grain has made consumers in the third world increasingly dependent on global grain markets, and therefore third world consumers are increasingly exposed to often violent fluctuations in grain prices. And the other major implication of increased corporate dominance of the food chain and the attendant increased prominence of grain in diets is that there has been an obesity epidemic that has emerged in the U.S. over the last 20 or 30 years. And also there has been an epidemic of diet-related diseases such as diabetes.
So let me start first with the third world. Why has this corporate dominance in grain dictated to the third world its need and dependence on, I mean, how did they eat before? I'm trying to figure out. I mean, they obviously, before there was this corporate dominance, they did have populations. Obviously, there were certain problems with climate and change that might have impacted their ability to grow certain things, and we know about droughts and whatever. But this is not related to failures of a climate. This is about controlling really the consumption of food. What happened where these grain distributors or grain growers were able to control what happens in third world? How the hell did that happen?
Well, I think we have to turn our attention to the early post-war period. Up until that point, a lot of people in third world countries were enjoying nutritionally diverse and very rich diets with multifarious carbohydrates, including tapioca, yam, cassava, and so on and so forth. But in the post-war period, American agriculture became lumbered with the problem of huge surpluses of grain. And when I'm talking of grain, I'm principally speaking about commodities such as wheat and corn. And the U.S. government tried to dispense of this grain and therefore reduce the burden on farmers who are obviously suffering from low grain prices. And they tried to dispense this grain via major grain traders such as Cargill and such as Continental, mm-hmm. who transported this grain to third world countries in the form of quote-unquote food aid. But this food aid really was basically food dumping, and it led to a homogenization of diets across the third world, and also in more advanced countries. So, for example, in Japan, rice obviously has been a key staple, which is historically defined diets in the country. But in the early 1950s, U.S. government agents actually encouraged schools in Japan to educate children to eat things like bread, which were actually quite exotic to Japanese people at the time.
So let me just stop you here, because Joe, I'm listening to a conversation that's going on right now in Congress, and it's about the fact that when we are supporting third world nations or nations that are suffering from significant poverty or significant need, there is now a conversation that says, rather than send them grain, like you were just describing, the grain dumping that Cargill did, that rather than do that, that turns out not to be as beneficial. Instead, give them the money and the tools so they can grow their own food, they can support their own farmers, they can create their own future, and in the end, you will actually stabilize those nations better than if we turn to a farmer of wheat in Iowa and sell it and dump it in, you know, I know, Kenya. That really isn't a good result for the country. It doesn't stabilize them. It doesn't provide them stability in the future. So it's really interesting that in some ways, I think they're hearing the mistake that you just described with the dumping that took place, you know, around the World War II, and maybe we're recognizing that in the long run is a really horrific strategy if helping is what we're claiming to do.
I agree with you, Arnie, to an extent, but I think there's a limit to this debate, which is that the kind of measures which U.S. government officials are proposing to third world governments is based on actually increasing their dependence on agribusiness-oriented farming solutions. So basically, the farming model that they're proposing would increase farmers' dependence on companies like Monsanto and DuPont to actually use agribusiness inputs such as fertilizer and pesticides, which, if used too gratuitously, leads to environmentally unsustainable outcomes. And I think a similar thing is being proposed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Charitable Foundation, and in my eyes, it's very limited.
Oh, God, I didn't know that. I didn't know this. I guess I should say thank you, but no thank you. I didn't want to know. Here I thought we were actually waking up and smelling the coffee, and now you're telling me they tainted the coffee. I can't stand it. All right, so we know that there was this food grain dumping, and that's in part sort of hooked, you know, third world nations, the Japanese, even other places around the world that were more sophisticated on beginning to embrace the American model, which wasn't necessarily a good model, but a model that kind of ensured obesity and diabetes. Thank you, America. But what else happened? Because it isn't just about foodstuffs. It's also about a consolidation that also looks, for example, ethanol isn't about food, but it directly impacts agribusiness and ultimately, I think, undermines food.
I would agree with you there completely, Arnie. In fact, over 40% of the corn crop produced in the U.S. today is used to produce ethanol. This is an extraordinary statistic because that is a lot of corn, obviously. And in fact, if we put in mind average grain consumption levels across the world, this amount of corn could actually feed 340 million people annually. So an incredible amount of grain, which should be used to feed human beings, is being diverted to produce fuel. And maybe, just maybe, this would be excusable if corn ethanol was a good fuel. But in fact, it's a completely lousy fuel.
I know.
In fact, I beg your pardon?
No, I'm crying because I know, but remind my audience why you were saying ethanol is a lousy fuel and why I am crying because I totally agree with you. And I actually say this in Iowa where they want to like cut my legs off. So explain to people why it is a bad fuel. Repeat, bad fuel. Why is ethanol such a terrible, terrible decision?
I'm very sorry to depress you, Arnie, and I'm sorry to depress your listeners, but it's a message that, as you'll probably agree, has to be put out.
Yes.
Ethanol is a lousy fuel because if we look at each gallon of corn ethanol, it contains only about 67% of the energy that is contained in the gallon of gasoline. Since the war on terror, after the events of the 9/11, there's been a lot of talk of increasing America's energy independence. And one solution which has been proffered is based on supporting the biofuels business in America.
Right, of course.
This argument about increasing energy independence through supporting biofuels is utterly dubious, Arnie. In fact, if we devoted the entire corn crop to the production of ethanol, it would cover only 12% of America's total gasoline usage.
God, and I also think not only are you talking about that, but if you do the cradle to grave analogy in the production of ethanol, it's a negative. You're not ahead. You're actually behind when it comes to energy production. And, you know, we're so convenient because we don't look at the full cycle. We tend to, look like a piece of a pie. Oh, look at it here. Oh, look at it there. Oh, look at it here. And you're right. It's dubious. Obviously, agribusiness loves it because we are supporting it and underwriting it. And in the end, it is such a lose for both farmers, for people that need food, and ultimately for the bottom line, for our dollars spent.
Exactly, and you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of studies do suggest that there is a net energy loss in the production of corn ethanol. But I think we should insert a caveat here, which is that not all ethanol produced in the world is as bad as corn ethanol. In fact, the ethanol produced from sugarcane in Brazil actually has a much higher and a much more impressive energy conversion ratio. I just think corn ethanol in the U.S. is particularly bad.
So how did we get salt? I'm looking at one of the comments in your piece. And again, let me remind everyone, we're talking with Joseph Baines. He's a doctoral student at York University in Toronto, Canada. His piece was entitled Food Price Inflation as Redistribution Towards a New Analysis of Corporate power in a world food system. And one of the points you make is there isn't one grain of anything in the world that is sold in a free market. Not one. The only place you see a free market is in the speeches of politicians. This is from the CEO of one of the world's second largest grain firms, ADM. I love it. But how did we get sold this bill of goods? What politician would want to buy something that was so damn inefficient, that didn't produce good results for the environment, didn't produce good results for fuel, didn't produce good results for consumption? Are these companies so good at manipulating everyone that they can buy people's heads and their souls?
Unfortunately, they can, it seems. Indeed, there is a revolving door between the upper echelons of corporations and also the apex of America's regulatory apparatus. And so corporations obviously wield a huge amount of influence over policymakers' decisions in the U.S.
Unbelievable.
Indeed, former CEOs or officials in agribusinesses often represent the U.S. in trade talks in the WTO after they finish their term in the corporation that they work for. So what we have is a completely incestuous system where the regulators and the regulated are the very same people.
Who gets this, Joseph? I mean, who understands and who's fighting back? I am obviously looking at what happened with the 2008 economic meltdown in Wall Street, and I see Wall Street winning. Okay, we lost. We lost in 2008. We continue to lose. The banks manipulate and control this place. We just elected a Democratic, quote-unquote, progressive congresswoman who just agreed to deregulate 99% of the derivatives, not 90% of the derivatives. And she's a progressive liberal Democrat, okay? So I am looking at what happened with the banking and financial world, and I'm looking at the Cargills and the ADMs and the Monsantos. And, for example, a lot of people don't know about Cargill. Cargill is probably one of the biggest corporations in the world, and the reason why they don't know it is that it's a basically kind of a family-owned, privately-owned company. They don't trade on the stock market, so you really don't even know how enormous it is. So given this story of corporate power, and given the consolidation, and given the manipulation, and now it's not just about food, now it's about fuel, it's not just about food and fuel, it's about keeping, you know, the third world beholden. Who gets it, and is there anyone fighting it?
When it comes to food, I think there are many people fighting, but they're fighting basically to forge their own independent paths when it comes to food production and food consumption. In fact, there are many inspiring initiatives across the world in which communities try and de-link or disconnect themselves from dependency on agribusiness. And in terms of who gets this very, very insidious and pernicious phenomena of rising corporate power in the American political system. Well, I think there are a number of scholars that kind of guess it, and I would like to actually refer your listeners to a website called bnarchives.net. That's bnfornannyarchives.net.
Okay.
And on that website, there's a huge amount of fascinating and fabulous contributions which actually illuminate the dark role that corporate power plays in American society and the global capitalist system at large.
Oh, God. But, you know, as you were writing this, I guess, Joseph, were you even shocked at what's happening with what you refer to as the agro core and the trader core and the retail core and the food core? As you started looking at what has happened over the course of decades, was there anything that you uncovered that you went, oh, my God, how did this happen, and how did we allow it to happen? Or was it like seamless, and it just seemed to sort of almost like an amoeba just continue to grow and grow in ways that we really weren't as aware as we should have been?
Yes, it's kind of like an amoeba, but it's not a shapeless phenomenon. In fact, there are contending corporate coalitions who are vying for control over the world food system. And I devised those categories that you just mentioned to highlight the divergences in the corporate interests in the American food system.
Were those competing interests ultimately, in the end, maybe protect us because everyone is fighting for turf? And I've always said this politically. The reason why I love a vibrant political system where you're not quite sure whether a Republican will win or a Democrat will win is that they keep each other honest and they keep each other in check. When you have this sort of monopoly of power, then it's anything they want is what becomes what you want because they get to dictate the rules. As you looked at these different cores that you were just describing, the food core, the retail core, the grain core, is that necessarily a bad thing or is that potentially a good thing? Because by this form of quote-unquote competition, they could actually maybe protect some positive result.
What I'm going to say now might depress you. I don't think this form of corporate contestation actually works like a liberal democratic system. It doesn't improve a lot of the underlying population. In fact, it might worsen it. So that's the depressing aspect of it, and I'll elaborate on that in a little while. But the inspiring aspect of that is that what we need is to actually radically break beyond our dependence on these corporations. We can't depend on them to compete against one another in such a way which would lead to positive outcomes for us. We need to actually look for non-corporate, democratically governed, and environmentally sustainable solutions on our own terms.
I only have a few minutes left. What would those solutions look like? Because I have a feeling I know what you would tell us from a negative perspective, but you said we have to sort of de-link, we have to unhook. So what are you talking about? Are you talking about that I have to go to my local farmer's market? Are you talking about going to my organic farmer? Are you like celebrating the locavore? I mean, what are we talking about? Because I'm trying to figure out what that solution looks like and, you know, whose door do I knock on to say, okay, I want to help, but where do I go?
Well, we can do very small things, which are nonetheless meaningful. I think, as you said, if we support local farmers, that's a very good step in terms of reducing our dependence on big food corporations. I think the omnivores among us should also try to eat less meat because enough of the grain that's actually produced in America is used for feeding livestock and feeding chickens and feeding swine. So if we reduce our consumption of meat, we're basically freeing up grain for people who perhaps need it more.
Right, right. So instead of having people having to compete with a cow, if we eat less cow, they'll actually have more to consume. You need to know that in our family, we describe it this way. Maybe this is a way for you to, since you'll be speaking to more people than I will ever speak to over the course of a lifetime, as a professor eventually, we refer to meat as a condiment. So when you use meat as a condiment, as opposed to making it one of the sort of the major food groups that you consume from, you've reduced your consumption of meat. You haven't eliminated it, but you've dramatically reduced it, and therefore you're using it in such a way that it would reflect what you were just describing, which is, you know, if we can do this, we can actually not only be healthier ourselves individually, but we can actually free up a lot of grain so that more people can be fed and fed in a way that's affordable.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So I see that. So eating less meat, getting more sort of involved at the local level. Anything else that's a little bit bigger or global or whatever, or is by definition any solution cannot be global? It has to be more at the local, hands-on level.
Yes, I'm a aspiring locavore, and I would suggest growing your own food. I have a friend who's going to start up his own herb garden, and in that respect, I mean, that could be seen to be a very small measure to de-link yourself from food corporations, but it's laudable. And I think if more people sought to grow their own food, if they have their little piece of land they can do it on, then again, we can reduce our dependence on food corporations.
And I'll leave you this way, Joseph. During World War II, people were having these things called victory gardens. And I almost feel like if you are passionate about your country, if you're passionate about your world, if you care about your neighbor, the idea of a victory garden is probably not such a bad thing. Because if all of us did that embrace of a victory garden, we might actually be victorious. It would be kind of amazing. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck on your PhD. And I hope you're successful in short order.
My pleasure. Enjoy your lunch.
All right. Thank you. Enjoy my lunch. Get out of here. Take care. Bye-bye, Joseph.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Joseph Baines. He is a doctoral student at York University in Toronto, Canada. And he looked at all these major, major corporate players and the change from sort of the idea that food was more being controlled at the retail level by the AMPs and the Walmarts to realizing it was being controlled by the companies like the Monsantos and the chemical companies, to then seeing that it being controlled by the sort of the grain manipulators, which are the Cargills. And by the time I got done reading this article, I'm like, oh, my God. You know what happened to a string bean? It got lost in the shuffle. And to see what we did to third world countries and his point, isn't it interesting, Marty? We were talking about Brazil during the break and saying that what Brazil is doing is they are actually throwing money at poor people in an effort to bring them into a place where they will acquire more wealth and be able to be more active participants in their society and create greater equality, and it's working. He mentioned Brazil too, and this time he was talking about the fact that not all ethanol is equally bad, and he referred to what Brazil was doing with sugar beets ethanol versus the kind of ineffective ethanol we have with corn. Both of them are not the best, but one is significantly worse than the other. And the one that is worse, the one that is inefficient, the one that produces the worst results is the one that we are embracing. Isn't that amazing? It's so fascinating that in the course of two conversations on two very different topics, where do we go? We end up talking about Brazil as a place to look. So I'm just telling everyone, you know, stop being neurotic about somehow the idea that whatever America does, it does well. Uh-uh, honey. We're making a bunch of mistakes. Didn't 2008 prove it for you? I mean, look what we made in the way of a financial mistake. So we're clearly capable of making other mistakes. I just want people to realize that. And here we have this conversation, one about the wealth gap, one about food and food power. And there's an example that goes to, ooh, the country of Brazil. And I'm thinking, where are we? Where are we? And speaking of that, the 556 video is on Facebook. And if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will. And that's from Brian Beal, our fabulous station manager. We played twice today from that video of a young man showing off his new Ruger. And we were able to produce how many bullets, Marty? We counted 58. 58. I want to remind everyone to make sure to let Chief Paul Donovan, president of the New Hampshire Association of Police Chiefs, know what you think. Here is his email, where it being so helpful, paul.donovan@nhchiefsofpolice.com. Let me repeat that email, paul.donovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at newhampshirechiefsofpolice.com. All right, we need to end this show with, of course, our favorite, But Think. Just